I've only been asked to speak three times here. The first time it was on liberation theology. The second time it was on the charismatic movement, and now on ecumenism. I was asking somebody whatever happened to ordinary subjects like the authority of Scripture or something like that. I just wait till I come to the last page. Thinks I'm kidding too. I was inducted only 2.5 weeks ago into my new charge, and life, as you can imagine, has been extremely busy, and I've not been able to give as much time to this as I would have liked. I apologise if there are some areas of the subject which I won't have time to cover today. The invitation to speak today follows upon something I said at the General Assembly in the debate on the report of the Board of World Mission and Unity. An elder from Martin Allen's church in Cryston, Norman Fleming, moved the following motion. Note with concern that the ecumenical movement is committed to unity without showing the same commitment to biblical doctrine and truth, with the resultant undermining of our Protestant heritage, and resolve that the continuation of this trend, as outlined at Swanwick, should be rejected. And I spoke in the debate on that motion. There's been a little confusion as to what I actually did say. When I met with the vacancy committee of Trinity Possel and Henry Drummond, the session clerk asked me about my views on ecumenism because he said he'd heard on the radio that I was urging closer relationships with the Roman Catholic Church. And Sandy, in his letter inviting me to speak today in his usual encouraging way, said that some of the brethren were perturbed. Can I begin then by clarifying what I did say? I admitted that I was in some difficulty over the motion because I agreed with the theological sentiments of the mover, but disagreed about method. I agreed that the ecumenical movement had often been more committed to unity than to truth, and I agreed that many of the pronouncements of the ecumenical bodies had concerned me. But I indicated that hostility towards the World Council of Churches and so on, or even withdrawal, was not the answer. And I then said this, and I read it, I was so nervous at the assembly, I'll do it again now. I believe that this motion is not the way forward. Evangelicals have for too long tended to criticise the ecumenical movement from the outside and to shout from the sidelines. I believe that the time has now come for evangelicals to desist from this unhelpful and negative approach and instead to play a full and committed part in working for Christian unity on the basis of Christian truth. If evangelicals feel that the ecumenical movement is not taking Christian doctrine and biblical truth seriously, then perhaps it's partly our own fault because we have not been prepared to take part in the dialogue. That must now change. We evangelicals must not exclude ourselves from the ecumenical process, but must say what we have to say from within rather than from without. Now, that wasn't a spur-of-the-moment idea, something which has been formulating for some time. I spoke to the TSF in Aberdeen 2 or 3 years ago on that same subject, and I've discussed with many people, some here, on the topic. Let me begin by making 2 general comments. Firstly, I believe it to be self-evident that Christian unity is a worthwhile objective and that such is the will of Christ as expressed in John 17. Secondly, I believe that the scandal of disunity is one of the most serious obstructions to Christian witness in the world today. What I have to say is divided into 5 main sections. Firstly, a description of certain forms of ecumenism which I believe to be unhelpful and unproductive. Secondly, a description of one form of ecumenism which I believe to be both necessary and important. Thirdly, a challenge to evangelicals to become involved in this form of ecumenism. Fourthly, a brief consideration of certain possible objections. And fifthly, and perhaps a little more controversially, and I'm tempted to remove it after the discussion this morning, some suggestions as to a possible program, if you'll excuse the word, for this brotherhood. First of all then, irrelevant ecumenism. There are two parts to the work of the ecumenical movement. On the one hand, there is what is called faith and order, which is concerned with the theological issues which divide the churches. On the other hand, there is what is called life and work, no relation to Bob Kernaghan, which is concerned with the practical task of bringing the denominations together to work on various projects, to have joint services, and so on. What I want to argue is that faith and order is real ecumenism, and is in fact the only ecumenism worthy of the name. I want to suggest that it's an important work, and to argue that it offers real possibilities for progress. Life and work, on the other hand, is a form of ecumenism which has tended to play down the importance of Christian doctrine, and which indeed has often treated doctrinal issues with casual indifference. This is ecumenism of the let's all get together and forget our differences variety, and I believe it to be fundamentally flawed. In other words, I believe that we ought to sit down with other denominations and discuss our theological differences and attempt to resolve them. I do not believe that getting together for joint services and so on, while leaving our differences unresolved, offers any real possibilities for Christian unity. Let me then give three examples of this life and work form of ecumenism, which I believe to be irrelevant and unacceptable. And the first one we might call grassroots ecumenism. There is great pressure upon ministers and congregations to be ecumenical at the local level. Unfortunately, this leads to what has been called ecumenism of the lowest common denomination type. There are, throughout the country, various councils of churches made up of several different denominations within a given area. This often means no more than a couple of joint services a year, but sometimes much more is involved. I was a member of the West End Council of Churches in Edinburgh for 2 years while serving as assistant minister there, and what I'm about to say is based partly on that experience. The problem which tends to remain unsolved is the agenda of such a council. Is the function of the council to organise various groups which are to be drawn from the member denominations, or to probe the differences between the member churches with a view to decreasing the number of the said differences? In my experience, the issues which divided us were left strictly aside. We never discussed the difference between Mass and Communion, or the validity of each other's ordination. We didn't discuss the doctrine of salvation or the meaning of baptism. And I came to the conclusion that this was not ecumenism at all. The goal of ecumenism, as I see it, is Christian unity, not simply to promote cooperation on non-controversial projects or to hold joint services. Grassroots ecumenism, although very vocal and very critical of those who refuse to take part, is doomed to failure because these important issues are left off the agenda. If in an industrial dispute management and trade unions were to agree to discuss everything under the sun except the one matter which had caused the dispute, then the problem would never be solved. And this ostrich-like attitude characterizes much that goes under the name of ecumenism. It might be very nice for people of different denominations to meet together in a friendly and informal setting, but ultimately it achieves nothing in terms of Christian unity, and it's foolish to pretend that it does. In many cases, we have the added problem that enthusiastic and well-meaning but theologically illiterate people who do not understand in the first place why there are differences between the denominations pretend that these are of no consequence after a couple of worship services together and refuse to listen to those who try to explain what the differences are and the issues from Scripture concerned. And then secondly, what I've called charismatic ecumenism. The charismatic movement has done a great deal to bring Christians of different denominations together. Unfortunately, with a few notable exceptions, such as Tom Smale, there has tended to be an anti-theological bias within the movement. In some cases, this could even be taken to be an understatement. This anti-theological bias becomes particularly apparent when discussing ecumenism. The charismatics tell us that they can bring people of different denominations together because of their, quote, unity in the Spirit and despite doctrinal differences. This is the case even when the theological differences are very great indeed. For example, in a discussion I had with some charismatics regarding their relationship with a Roman Catholic group, I was told that the doctrinal differences were irrelevant, and even to discuss them was both divisive and unnecessary. Now, please don't misunderstand me. I think that over the next 10 or 15 years, the most fruitful area of ecumenical dialogue might well be between Roman Catholics and evangelicals. And the recent work done by John Stott and Basil Meek in this area is extremely stimulating. But that's quite a different matter from suggesting that we can come together for worship despite our differences. As a general working principle, it seems to me that if we can agree on the fundamentals of the faith, then worship together is possible, whatever our denomination. Otherwise, all contact must be at the level of theological dialogue. Charismatic ecumenism holds out a light of hope which will be extinguished by the harsh reality of our theological differences. And then thirdly, ecumenism by sleight of hand is the best I could come up with. By this title, I mean that kind of ecumenism which tries to bring the denominations together in an illicit way through liturgical or other means. That is to say, forms of words which are concocted to suggest a unity that does not exist in reality. Let me give two examples from the 1979 Book of Common Order. First of all, the very layout of the book. It's laid out in such a way that anyone not familiar with the Church of Scotland picking the book off the shelf would assume that we had communion every Sunday. In the introduction we read, "By this arrangement, the committee gives clear expression again to the normative character of the service of word and sacrament." There are three orders of service for communion, taking up to about 40 pages. Then a two-page outline for Sunday service when the Lord's Supper is not celebrated, followed by another short order for communion. Now, there is no way in which this can be said to be the common order of the Church of Scotland. Most churches have communion about four times per year. The compilers of this book clearly believe that communion should be the normative service and take place each Sunday. And we could argue about that. But that view is out of step with the church at large. It is, however, very much in step with the liturgical arm of the ecumenical movement. So in other words, a Book of Common Order has been foisted upon us in which some Scoto-Catholics tell us what they think we ought to be doing every Sunday. And it's been done in the service of ecumenism. The other example of sleight of hand comes from the actual words which are used in the communion service, although some aspects of this is also applicable to the previous book. In the communion service, we find the Agnus Dei, Lamb of God, who takes away the sin of the world, have mercy upon us. This prayer is taken from the Roman Catholic Mass, and in that context of the Mass is addressed to the bread and wine, which by that time in the service has been transubstantiated into the actual body and blood of Christ. As far as the priest is concerned, it is an address to Christ on the table. Now, for us to use the Agnus Dei makes a nonsense of our understanding of what is happening in the sacrament. And I've often challenged people within the Church of Scotland who use the Agnus Dei to justify its inclusion. And the answer is always the same. We are not using it in the same way that the Roman Catholics do. For us, it is addressed to Christ in heaven, seated at the right hand of God. But this is ecumenism by sleight of hand. We use the same words at the same point in the service, and yet say that we mean something completely different. And so the cause of ecumenism is furthered. And when churches discuss liturgy, there is no problem because we all use the same words. If, as I did recently, you read over the 1979 Book of Common Order, the Anglican Service Book, and the Catholic Missal, you will see how astonishingly successful the liturgical people have been in bringing the denominations together. They could never in a million years persuade their respective denominations to agree theologically on the nature of the sacraments. So they've done it themselves by finding agreement in the form of words which are used. Now these examples could be multiplied. The Epiclesis and the communion service, the commendation of the deceased to God, which to my simple mind seems awfully like praying for the dead. And certain expressions in the baptismal service, which could suggest easily a belief in baptismal regeneration. In each case, we have ecumenism by sleight of hand. Now, I am opposed to all these forms of ecumenism. But my second main section is to say that there is an ecumenism which I think is both important and necessary, namely the faith and order strand of the movement. This involves looking honestly at those theological matters on which we disagree and making a determined effort to come to an agreed position, putting our prejudices and traditions behind us in the search for biblical truth. This has always been an integral part of the ecumenical movement. Let me give you a brief history lesson. In 1910, the World Missionary Conference convened in Edinburgh, and as D.P. Gaines wrote, it was considered necessary, in order to preserve unity, to exclude from the discussions all the questions relating to faith and order. From 1910 onwards, however, the faith and order side of the ecumenical movement grew in strength. Credit for the serious beginnings of this must be given to C.H. Brent, who was the Protestant Episcopal Bishop of the Philippines, who, in his report from the aforementioned World Missionary Conference, said that the time had come for the churches to get together and discuss their distinctive theological perspectives, and in particular, those points on which they disagreed. This initiative led to preparatory meetings in Geneva, Stockholm, and Bern, and subsequently to the First World Conference of Faith and Order in Lausanne in 1927. The Second World Conference on Faith and Order met in Edinburgh in 1937. After this, the Faith and Order movement joined with the Life and Work movement to form the World Council of Churches. The main concern of Life and Work, as I've indicated, had been the encouragement and sponsorship of projects where the churches worked together despite their theological disagreement. The World Council of Churches took 11 years to become a reality and was not actually constituted until the first assembly in Amsterdam in 1948. Now, from this point on, the faith and order emphasis became part of the overall work of the World Council of Churches, producing reports from time to time and holding various conferences, the next one being the Third World Conference on Faith and Order, held in Lund in 1952. Previous to this, the movement had appointed various commissions to study aspects of its overall work, but they were all disbanded at Lund, the intention being to strengthen the World Council of Churches by ensuring that the concerns of faith and order were voiced in the central organization and not in a peripheral, perhaps even superfluous movement. Nevertheless, faith and order conferences have taken place from time to time on specific topics sponsored by the World Council of Churches. Now, the point of this survey is to demonstrate the rise of faith and order as a vehicle for the aspirations of many within various denominations to deal with the theological issues which divide them. Not only so, but also to show how within a comparatively short time, faith and order was absorbed into the larger grouping while retaining a place of prominence and influence. Sadly, however, in the 1960s and 70s, the influence of faith and order receded. Indeed, at the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland in 1979, the Reverend Professor T.F. Torrance expressed the view that the World Council of Churches had lost much of the faith and order emphasis in its ecumenical endeavours, and he suggested that such organisations as the World Alliance of Reformed Churches should be admitted to the World Council of Churches on equal terms with member churches in order to correct this imbalance. Now, laying aside whether or not this is a realistic solution to the problem as perceived by Professor Torrance, it is of interest that someone of the international reputation of T.F. Torrance should go on record as saying, in effect, that the World Council of Churches was not paying enough attention to Christian doctrine. But why was this the case? Why did doctrine slip far down the agenda? 6 years ago, I gave a paper at this October conference on liberation theology. And in that paper, I drew a comparison between the World Council of Churches Assembly, which took place in New Delhi in 61, and the Assembly which took place in Uppsala in 68. And in that paper, I argued that the WCC had been politicized and that Uppsala marked a turning point in its work. The work of the movement throughout the 70s and into the 80s was taken up with the quest for social justice and the political liberation of the oppressed, the word oppressed having been broadened to include women, homosexuals, and other socially oppressed groups. Now, I don't want to go over any of that again, but simply to note that the time and energy of the World Council of Churches was taken up with matters of a socio-political nature, and so the faith and order strand of the movement suffered accordingly. The World Council of Churches then had gone from a position in 1910 where it prohibited the discussion of doctrinal issues lest the missionary conference be divided, to a position in the 70s and early 80s where it neglected doctrine in favour of such projects as the programme to combat racism. Now, if that trend had continued, I do not think I would have been standing here today to make the case for evangelicals to be involved in the ecumenical movement. But things have changed, and there has been a swing of the pendulum such that doctrinal issues are now back in the forefront of the ecumenical process. Let me give three examples. First of all, the filioque clause. This will be familiar to all of you, I'm sure, but you'll forgive me if I refresh your memory on some of this. The controversy over the doctrine of the Trinity, occasioned by the views of Arius, led to the Council of Nicaea in AD 325. A creed was formulated to end the disputes which had raged in the church. The second form of the Nicene Creed was the one approved by the Second Ecumenical Council, Constantinople, in AD 381. This is commonly referred to as the Niceno-Constantinople Creed and is the text which is used in the Eastern Church. The Holy Spirit is spoken of as proceeding from the Father. The third form of the creed is the one used in the Latin or Western Church, and the difference is in one word or clause in English, filioque. In other words, this third form of the creed asserts that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. Philip Schaff traces the first appearance of that clause in the Nicene Creed to the Third Council of Toledo in Spain in AD 589. Others trace it to a council of Spanish bishops in Lusitania in AD 412. But here surely is the classic example of a theological difference which divides the church. The Orthodox churches have always regarded what they have always resented what they regard as a unilateral addition to the creed. Now, I'm aware of the argument that the real difference was the rival pretensions to leadership of Rome and Constantinople, but for present purposes, I take it that that filioque clause was the real cause of division. The church, East and West, divided over one Latin word. Now, Reformed theology from Calvin onwards, through the creeds and confessions of the 16th and 17th centuries, followed the pre-Reformation Western Church and affirmed the filioque clause. That's the tradition in which we find ourselves today in Scotland. But recently, Reformed theologians have begun to look again into the wording of the Nicene Creed as part of their ecumenical discussions with the Orthodox churches. There is a serious attempt being made to solve that problem, and I find that a stimulating development. Dr. Alistair Heron, formerly of New College, has contributed significantly to that debate, both in his own article and in a report of the Church of Scotland panel on doctrine. He approaches the whole subject as a problem of Trinitarian theology and draws on the theology of the Reformation while making clear steps towards a solution. Now, I don't want to go into the details here because I'm only using it as an example. And in any case, I have reservations about some aspects of Dr. Heron's argument. But the important point is that ecumenical work of a faith and order variety is being done, which contains a real possibility of success in some reunification or realignment or closer relations between the churches of East and West. And that would be the most significant development for certainly many, many years. The second example of faith and order work being done is the document Baptism, Eucharist and Ministry. I assume that by now you're all familiar with this title, also known as the Lima document, which was approved by the Faith and Order Commission of the World Council of Churches in 1982. This text seeks to present a statement on each of the three major points of theological divergence among the denominations represented in the WCC, together with other churches who had observers at the commission. Now, I find myself in the awkward position of disagreeing with almost every one of its major statements, yet enthusiastically welcoming it as the most positive document to come out of the WCC for years. Now, the reason for this apparent mental confusion is simple. I welcome wholeheartedly the fact that the World Council of Churches has given itself to the task of dealing with the causes of theological disunity, but I yet reserve the right to disagree with their conclusions. I believe that it can be shown to teach baptismal regeneration, Eucharistic sacrifice, and a priestly understanding of ministry. Just to begin with. But once again, but the point is not to go into the merits and demerits of a particular debate, but simply to note that such discussions are taking place and that the World Council of Churches is producing documents like that today and much less of the program to combat racism variety. Third example, the multilateral conversation. Over the past few years, the Church of Scotland, the Congregational Union of Scotland, the Scottish Episcopal Church, the Methodist Synod in Scotland, the United Free Church of Scotland, and the United Reformed Church have been working together. A couple of years ago, they produced a document entitled Christian Unity, Now is the Time. The General Assembly, when it received the report, decided that now was probably not the time, but nevertheless encouraged continuing work on the various areas of disagreement. And out of this came the Panel and Doctrines report on ministry. Once again, I find myself out of sympathy with some of the conclusions, but yet encouraged that such work is taking place. Now, we could go on to mention the report God's Reign and Our Unity from the Anglican Reformed International Commission, or the final report of the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission, Archic 2, on justification. That in itself is a remarkable document, and so on. But surely the point has been made. The faith and order side of the ecumenical movement is alive and well and is making major efforts to deal with our doctrinal differences. This is the positive side of ecumenism. Now, my third section is entitled Evangelical Involvement. Let me ask you this. What would the final reports of all these councils, conferences, and commissions have looked like if there had been a heavy evangelical involvement? Is it not the case, I'm departing from my notes, you'll excuse me, is it not the case that for us to criticize the reports of ecumenical commissions and conferences when we refuse to be there to take part is no different from Jack Glass standing outside the General Assembly and complaining about our decisions? If we dissociate ourselves, then I think we have less grounds for complaint than we would otherwise have. But to be fair, the problem has been that those who are involved in the ecumenical dialogue between the denominations are often not properly representative of the churches they are sent from. In other words, if the Church of Scotland wants to send people to the British Council of Churches, as was, or the World Council of Churches, or whatever, they send people who are committed to ecumenism, rather than people who are broadly representative of the whole denomination and of the different strands within the denomination. And so the professional ecumenicists get together and they come up with a formula which is agreeable to all of them. They take it back to their own denominations and it gets thrown out. Because the people we sent were committed to ecumenism and did not adequately represent their own denominations. For example, in a discussion between a Presbyterian and a Roman Catholic, there's going to be all the difference in the world in the results, depending upon who is chosen to represent each side. If the representatives are Archbishop Lefebvre and the Reverend Dr. Ian Paisley, there's going to be very little in the way of a meeting of minds and even less in the way of common ground. But you get Hans Kung and W.B. Johnston together.
Oh.
Is this being recorded? Then it would be quite a different matter. Those who are chosen to represent the denominations determine the outcome. It's my contention that evangelicals must be prepared to get involved in the ecumenical dialogue. The international evangelical movement is now stronger than it has ever been. Even here in Scotland, there are now more evangelical students in the theological colleges than ever before, a fact which clearly disturbs some people in high places. The time has come for us to move out of our own circles and begin to make a contribution to the wider church. Ecumenism is too important a task to leave to those who refuse to take the claims of Scripture and Orthodox theology seriously. We certainly have nothing to be afraid of. Our theological position is strong and can be defended without great difficulty. It was my experience in a very liberal and radical theological seminary in the United States that those who take an evangelical position are almost invariably better read, because we have been forced to read all the liberal textbooks in order to get through college, and at the same time have read books of more orthodox theology. And so we are well able to cope in the theological jungle, which is the ecumenical movement. And we must break out of the inferiority complex which has persuaded us for too long that we cannot compete on equal terms with the liberals and radicals. I think, too, we have a responsibility to the countless thousands of people, ordinary church members, who are being led in a direction which is away from orthodoxy because they are part of this ecumenical movement. The ecumenical movement is not about to go away, and whether we are there or not, discussions will take place and decisions will be made. And it's my contention that if we are there, we will be able to affect the outcome and move the churches in the direction of evangelical theology. And so there are three justifications for our involvement to let our voice be heard, the voice of evangelical orthodoxy. Secondly, to reform the world church. It's not a wild dream. And thirdly, to be faithful to Christ, who prayed that we might be one. And then fourthly, and very briefly, because I'm sure that other objections will be raised later, four possible objections to this argument. And the first objection, simply, which is often raised, is guilt by association. Well, let me just say in a sentence that if we really believed that, we wouldn't be in this denomination in the first place.
That's true.
Secondly, secondly, they wouldn't listen. They wouldn't listen. After I spoke in the assembly, three people in particular come up to me to thank me for my speech and said that they hoped that evangelicals would get involved. And these three seemed to me to be prepared to cooperate to make sure that this was done. Robin Barber, the chairman of what was the Scottish Council of Churches. Douglas Murray, the chairman of the Panel on Doctrine. Chris Wigglesworth, the general secretary of the Board of World Mission and Unity. They're listening. They want evangelicals to be involved. Thirdly, we wouldn't achieve anything. The evangelicals in the Church of England would not agree. They have achieved a great deal for the cause of the gospel in a denomination which in many parts is more liberal and radical than ours. And because of that, they've been able to contribute to the ecumenical dialogue even beyond the confines of Anglicanism. The work that John Stott has done in this area is truly remarkable and bespeaks a tremendous initiative. We can achieve things that evangelicals in other countries have. And thirdly, it would be a waste of time and energy. If Christian unity is a proper objective, and if the scandal of disunity is as damaging as I believe it to be, then it cannot be wrong to spend time and energy seeking to achieve the first and to resolve the second. Not only so, but how can it be a waste of time to seek to persuade people from other denominations, and indeed in our own denomination, of the truth of Orthodox Christianity? That should be a calling which we accept without hesitation. And lastly, have I time for... I don't think I have time for this. Never this. Yes. I was asking Sandy what you have to do to lose your invitation to Crete. Terrified. I enjoy my Januaries at Crete. The last section is entitled Programme, if you'll excuse the word, for the Crete Brotherhood. May I begin by using the evangelical Anglicans as a model. They have been able to make a contribution to the British Council of Churches and the World Council of Churches and other ecumenical endeavours primarily because of the strength of their position within their own denomination. And that strength comes in no small part from the fact that they are organised and they are recognised. They're organized and they're recognized. May I say in passing that they have been able to get so many people onto the British Council of Churches that I recently wrote to the British Council of Churches Evangelism Committee and persuaded them to set up a working party on the doctrine of regeneration, which they've agreed to do, mainly because evangelical Anglicans were there to speak in a similar vein. Now, I see in this a possible avenue for our own group here. I believe that we are now strong enough to make a contribution to the ecumenical movement. But if we're to be able to do this, we must do it from a position of strength within our own denomination. I hope you'll excuse me if this sounds uncharacteristically provocative. It's really simply to cause discussion later. I think that perhaps the time has come for us to flex our ecclesiastical muscles. We've been thinking too small. We've been a minority for so long that we've not fully realized the strength of our position today within the church. I believe that the slogan "quiet infiltration" represented the correct strategy for a small brotherhood, but I would suggest that the time has come for us to realize and to demonstrate to the church that we are such no longer. Can I suggest that our objectives as a brotherhood should be as follows? Firstly, to become an organized force within the Church of Scotland so as to maximise our influence. Now, I don't want us to become like the Iona community, but I do think that we could learn from the example of the Evangelical Anglicans. Nor do I want us to become a party within the church. Our objective must always be a church which is reformed and reforming. But perhaps we have to take one or two preliminary steps in order to achieve that goal. Secondly, we should try to make sure that we have adequate evangelical representation on all the committees and boards of the church, and similarly ensure that each time an ad hoc committee is set up, that evangelicals are represented. In particular, we must insist that evangelicals are represented on the panel on doctrine and on all the constituent committees of the Board of World Mission and Unity, especially those selected for ecumenical dialogue. And I believe that we're strong enough now to ask and receive those things. Thirdly, to make contact with other Reformed evangelicals in the United Kingdom, especially the Reformed Presbyterian denominations in Scotland, so as to maximise our strength in the ecumenical movement as a whole. I personally would envisage the setting up of some kind of Westminster Fellowship where the Reformed evangelicals, particularly ministers from the Scottish Presbyterian denominations, could meet to discuss matters of common interest with the clear objective of the reunification of Scottish Presbyterianism. That, I believe, is a realistic objective and a realistic ecumenical objective within Scotland. I think the alternative, if we're not prepared to act boldly in order to attain the kind of position within the central courts of the church which we ought to have because of our strength, I think the alternative is to run the risk of becoming increasingly isolated within the Church of Scotland, compromising on a regular basis, women elders, in order to stay within the denomination. The clear objective of the reunification of Scottish Presbyterianism. That, I believe, is a realistic objective and a realistic ecumenical objective within Scotland. I think the alternative, if we're not prepared to act boldly in order to attain the kind of position within the central courts of the church which we ought to have because of our strength, I think the alternative is to run the risk of becoming increasingly isolated within the Church of Scotland, compromising on a regular basis, women elders, in order to stay within the denomination. We would thus watch the gradual but eventual triumph of secular humanism in the church from behind the barricades in a diminishing conservative enclave. Rather like, if Fergus will forgive me, the way in which the Free Church has largely been reduced to a rump north and west of the Highland Line. We are at an important stage in the interchurch process. With the ending of the BCC and the Scottish Council of Churches and the planning and preparation of new ecumenical instruments, as they're called, it is literally about to begin afresh. If we were in there at the beginning as a recognised group, if we were able to be involved in all the debates and negotiations, then I believe that we could achieve something. I believe that we're also at a crucial stage in our own denomination, and I think that the time has come to stand up and demand that we be taken seriously. Thank you.